The speakers will begin in a moment.
The point of view of church leaders, and since the only really preemptive standard that we have for gauging movies is the rating system, they understandably fall back on that. So I can understand that. At the same time, everybody who's a member of the church at one point had hands laid on their head, and they were confirmed and given the gift of the Holy Ghost, which is supposed to give you that companionship to discern for yourselves if something is or is not going to be conducive to keeping the Spirit in your lives. So with that, I've been able to go ahead and sort of, I guess over the course of about 10 years and more, develop my own strategies for what is and is not uplifting to me. And many of the most uplifting films I've ever seen are R-rated. I think Billy Elliot left me not just with a lump in my throat, left me with a lump in my chest. Billy Elliot is not rated R because it contains anything in terms of graphic violence, nudity, sex, whatever. It's rated R for language. And it just happens that that language is the natural language of blue-collar, working-class British miners. This is how these people talk. To them, it's not profanity. To us, it's profanity. But I showed the movie just as in sort of preparation for this panel. I showed my mother Billy Elliot about a week and a half ago. Normally, a four-letter word in a movie will send her into a tantrum. She won't know what to do. She'll focus on it. She'll fixate on it. And that's the only thing she'll remember. They were vulgar in that movie. She had no problems with Billy Elliot because it was organic. You know, she was once a nanny in Scotland, so she was exposed to the way that people talk in blue-collar British environments. The Joy Luck Club, one of my favorite films of all time. Rated R, as the FBAA indicated in its bulletin, for intense depiction of thematic material. What does that mean? So we could go on and on about that, and we'll talk about this later as to the reliability of the MPAA and their rating system. But I think with all due respect to what church leaders have in mind when they counsel the youth and certainly other people about R-rated movies, we need to understand that that is not equivalent to uplifting. Now, what do I consider uplifting? Most of the films that I see that I consider uplifting, they tend to be independent films, foreign films. They are not mainstream Hollywood studio films. And that's because they are marketed to niche audiences. They are marketed to people with perhaps more sophisticated tastes, people with diverse interests. I think Richard Dutcher has done a wonderful job of proving the value of niche audiences with his films. And I was one of the doubters many years ago when I was in a room with Richard when he was trying to pitch some representatives of Bonneville Communications on the fact that there's an LDS community that wants to see movies and it's a valuable and viable niche audience. And I sat there and I kind of rolled my eyes and I thought, Richard, you're out of your mind. You know, it's not going to happen. They can go to the church library and they can rent all the church videos they want and they're not going to pay for a movie about missionaries. I was wrong. They did. And they paid to see Brigham City as well, and they're paying to see The Other Side of Heaven. Again, it depends on what your definition of uplifting is. But if you look hard enough, you will find movies that are uplifting. But it's for a certain generation who predates the 1968 to 1970 period, that may become harder and harder. And that's because there were two crucial changes that happened in that period. One was the formation of the FPAA and the rating system in 1968, which allowed movies of more intense themes and tougher subject matter to begin being made by the mainstream studios. And the other was a change in 1970 in the leadership of CBS. A man by the name of Robert Wood took over the reins from the legendary Bill Paley. Bill Paley, in 1960, realized that most of the people in the country now had televisions, not just people in the cities, but people in the rural parts of the country. So he put Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and Andy Griffith Show and Gomer Pyle and all of these, the Red Skelton Show, these shows were put on the air in the 60s. By 1970, Robert Wood realized that the people who lived in these parts of the country weren't buying things, so the advertisers were getting antsy. And he canceled a lot of these top-rated shows and replaced them with All in the Family, Mary Tyler Moore Show, MASH, things that had a more city appeal, things that catered to people who would buy things. Now, that has continued to today. Those of us who may feel like we have Midwestern sensibilities, small town sensibilities, more sort of rural and wholesome sensibilities, often look at television as this wasteland of you know, decadence. Even shows that are on at like 8 o'clock, Friends. A lot of people have a hard time with Friends because it talks liberally about sexual matters and so forth. And that's simply because the tradition from 1970s continued to today. But, again, if you look hard enough, we have 100 times as much television programming today as there was in 1970. If you look hard enough, you'll find what you're looking for. And the thing to remember about good and bad television programming, or movies, or anything else, it's a bell curve, and it's always going to be. If something, by definition, is above average, it doesn't constitute most of the material. So whatever is above average, whatever is good, whatever is excellent, is always going to be a minority. And those of us that want to find it, I think it's our responsibility to seek it out, but I know that it exists.
See if we can understand we don't need this for amplification, but for posterity.
I'm Lisa Cannon, and I'm just going to share a little bit with you more from the perspective of music, which is where I've had my experience, and maybe wax a little philosophical with you. But as Wade was talking, I thought about in my youth, I grew up in Laguna Beach and went to high school in the late 60s and early 70s, and it was just getting pat, you know, it was still kind of the hippie era and flower power and all that. And we had moved there from Arizona in the early 60s, and I just loved music already. I already loved rock music before I moved there, but even more so when I got there, and I was very influenced by the culture and the times. But oddly enough, I was only influenced because of my joy for music. I loved the rhythms. I loved listening to everything from, you know, the Bob Dylan and the Joan Baez to the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young to Cream, which I just loved, The Doors, Led Zeppelin, you know. It got pretty wild for that time. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. But I wasn't influenced, for some reason, in the other ways that seemed to come with, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I got the rock and roll part. I didn't partake of the sex and the drugs. And I don't know why, but that was just the way I was. And I felt a real strong faith from my youth in our gospel. But somehow I loved this music too. And I guess my whole life I've been trying to figure out, why am I attracted so to this music, and how do I make it consistent with what I feel inside about life and truth? And in later years, I mentioned I played piano since I was about 8, and loved classical and jazz, and slowly started to learn how to improvise music, and then came into songwriting. And it was always a struggle for me in the early 80s to, as I was really doing this songwriting, to figure out how I could say what I wanted to say, how I wanted to express my feelings, my experiences in life, which were a little different than what was typically being talked about in these kind of songs and in this kind of music, and how I could make it come up and somehow impart truth and somehow convey this feeling I felt about the goodness of life and the hope in life, and yet not make it sound, you know, definitely not make it sound religious, and hopefully not make it sound too odd, you know. So it's been quite a struggle, and I just kept experimenting with it, and I played in wild rock bands, and jammed incessantly, and played in clubs way into the night, and in situations that you think might not be conducive to that, and yet somehow I just always felt like I could maybe impart a spirit even in that environment. And that's what I've tried to do, and I enjoy doing that, and it has affected quite a few people apparently that have enjoyed my music. And this morning as I was getting ready to come here, I was just trying to think of, you know, I was looking at the broader picture of what is art. We're talking here about uplifting entertainment, but I'm going to talk about it in a sense of just what is art and what is uplifting about it? And I turned again to this book by Leo Tolstoy. He's one of my heroes, as you might have realized from last night. But I thought this was interesting. He defines art as to evoke in oneself a feeling one has experienced. Then, by means of movements, lines, colors, sounds, or forms expressed in words, so to transmit that feeling that others can experience what you've been feeling. That's the activity of art. Art is a human activity, and it hands to others feelings that we have lived through, so other people can be infected by those feelings and also experience them. And I thought, oh, that's so neat, because I love to express myself through lyrics and through the movement of music and the rhythms and the melodies and the harmonies and the chordal voicings on the piano. And it is such a great way to express oneself and deal with one's own life. It's kind of like that feeling you get when you're writing a journal and you're just sorting it all out. What is this life? What is it all about? And I love to be able to express myself and hopefully touch others through that, making that expression somewhat universal. And then there was a chapter in here that talked about, you know, well, how are we to decide what is good or bad in the subject matter of art? I thought, well, this is interesting. Here's Tolstoy talking about this. Of course, he had quite a religious spirit himself. And I thought this was really interesting, the way he talked about it. He talked about art as evolving and being an evolution of feeling, and that as art feelings, as the evolution of feeling proceeds through art feelings that are less kind and less needful for the well-being of mankind, they are replaced by others that are kinder and more needful for that end. And so he's saying that the good art is the kind that would instill these feelings of kindness and truth and love. And of course, we all interpret that maybe a little bit differently, which makes it so much fun and so interesting. But, and perhaps he's saying that that would then replace the art that is perhaps less fulfilling in that need of mankind to feel these emotions and to feel hope and so forth. And I thought, you know, that for me is kind of what I've decided to make my art about. I could go a lot of different directions in music. It's definitely, you know, there's a sensuality about rock music. There's maybe that's one thing that attracts me to it. And yet, through that feeling, I've also wanted to impart a testimony. I want to impart a testimony of life, a testimony of joy, a testimony of living, a testimony of Christ. Maybe not in so many words, but you know how it says in the scriptures that when you look around you, everything testifies of Christ. Nature, birds, mountains. And I really do believe that with all my heart. And that's kind of how I look at art and at entertainment. And what appeals to me is when it somehow touches us of what's really important at the end of the day, you know? Lyric that I was really touched on by a CD by Jewel that she came out with a few years ago, in her song Hands, she talks about, in the end, only kindness matters. And in fact, I just wanted to read you one little part from that because it's one of my favorite songs. She says, if I could tell the world just one thing, it would be that we're all okay. Not to worry, because worrying is wasteful and useless in times like these. I won't be made useless. I won't be idle with despair. I will gather myself around with my faith, for light does the darkness most fear. And she goes on in the chorus, and she says, in the end, only kindness matters. And that was just one lyric that's inspired me lately. I mean, there's so many artists that I love who tell stories who I think are uplifting. Bruce Springsteen is one of my heroes, and Bono and so forth, and the passion that they sing with. Anyway, so that's what I look for in art and entertainment. And I believe with all my heart there is a way to do it that is intriguing, that is very high art, that is captivating, that is deep, that that will capture the truth that lives inside of everyone's heart. And that's what I'm hoping there's more and more of. I think that was a great appeal of Christ to the people. He had great audiences. I suppose you could call it entertaining. He did attract great audiences, and it was very uplifting, and it was not just telling them what to do. It was full of parables and intriguing things to bring their social consciousness and awareness on a higher plane and bring them to experience these things. And so that's my testimony and my feeling, and I just have to read this one other lyric, not to go overboard on Jewel. I like her a lot, but she, I wish I had written this lyric. This is a lyric I could have written, but she wrote it. So it's in a song called Life Uncommon. It goes, "I've heard your anguish, I've heard your hearts cry out. We are tired, we are weary, but we aren't worn out. Set down your chains until only faith remains. Set down your chains and lend your voices only to the sounds of freedom. No longer lend your strength to that which you wish to be free from. Fill your lives with love and bravery, and we shall lead a life in common. Come on, all you unbelievers. Move out of the way. There's a new army coming. We are armed with faith."
Give a backwards applause for Wade, and we didn't applaud for, but we should have. We were not establishing the time.
Yeah.
We're all getting comfortable with each other, and that's fine. Rich?
Well, I don't know how much I have to say about all this, but I think.
Rich, can you use the mic? This.
Yeah, the air conditioning has become our enemy. And speak from the diaphragm, Rich. Really project. Make this your day.
Yeah, sure. I think there's a difference between uplifting entertainment and entertainment that's enlightening. And I see a lot of independent films because of the film festival. Every year we get, this year we got 2,500 movies submitted to the festival.
We watch every one of them.
Thankfully, I don't actually have to watch the majority of those films. I just watch the sort of short list of those movies. But I think, you know, I see a trend in a lot of filmmakers that are trying to make films right now, especially in the independent world. And many times they're trying to, they're seeking answers or seeking understanding. And through sort of the exploration of their stories and making a movie, they sort of, either they found some sort of answer that they want to share, or they're on this journey and this quest. And sometimes those stories go down really dark paths for that type of, for enlightenment, for understanding as to what is life about, why, you know, why do I feel this way, why do I have this sexual orientation, why do I, and society tells me that's not right. Is it okay to feel it? And, or you know, any number of issues. And then you have things that are enlightening. And what might be enlightening to you, me and you is not, or I'm sorry, uplifting. What might be uplifting to me and you might not be uplifting to other people. They might find it to be manipulative and to be untrue. So I think it's a really personal thing. And in terms of my viewpoint on it is, I appreciate cinema that is uplifting. I'd like to be a part of that, but I also recognize that there's a lot of value in cinema that's also enlightening. And I just have a small story. Last year, I see all films unrated. I have no idea what I'm going to watch when I put in a video cassette. I got a tape in. It was a movie called Southern Comfort, and I had no idea what it was about. And And I'm watching this movie about, I thought it, at first I thought, oh, this is about backwoods, really, really sort of backwoods men that are, live really in the deep south and are kind of a little mixed up and have an unusual sort of view on life. And about halfway through the movie, I discovered that actually I'm watching women that are transgender, that have made themselves to be men, which was interesting when I finally figured it out. I'm like, oh, these are actually women, and this is what the, this journey of this film is about, watching these people. And, you know, it's not... I'm a pretty conservative person. I don't know a lot about transgender relationships or transgender folks. But I found... And it wasn't necessarily an uplifting experience where I felt like I could... I was, you know... My spirit was uplifted. But I did feel like I had a better insight into the struggles that some people go through. And in that way, it was an enlightening one, I thought, for me. Now, it was also kind of a difficult experience because it's funny, I work with a bunch of ex-Mormons in my office, and one of them made the comment after seeing Tasha's film, Church of the Screens Tonight. She says, it's so funny because, you know, I grew up and I was raised in Salt Lake, and Mormons tend to put bad things away and never want to look at them. And it's like you can almost sort of move on from that if you don't think about it. And I thought to myself, you know, you're speaking about me. That's exactly how I'm built. I don't like to think about bad things. I don't like to relive bad experiences. I tend to try to categorize them, understand them, and I try to not think about them again. And I think that that not everybody has to be enlightened. It's not everybody's call. Somebody in Layton, Utah might not need to be exposed to a film about transgender relationships. I'm not so sure that's important. And for me, was it important? Ultimately, probably yes, because I live in a culture where I deal with a lot of diverse people and a lot of different diversity, and I feel like I need to understand a little bit of what their side is. So, I think uplifting entertainment is fantastic. I actually disagree. I don't think a lot of it is being made. Every once in a while, I'll see a film that I feel like, wow, my spirit's really elevated. But I do see a lot of enlightening entertainment, where I see something, I mean, like Krzysztof Kieslowski's like trilogy, to me, is not uplifting. But it does leave me with something. I'm sort of enlightened about it. These people, their stories, their world. You know, I don't feel closer to God, but I certainly feel closer a little bit to humanity. So, thank you.
Well, I've been kind of involved in this subject or kind of a search for uplifting entertainment, entertainment that inspires you and elevates you for a while. Just having gone to UCLA and making some of my own short films and going around to a lot of film festivals and came across a film festival in Indianapolis. I don't know if any of you are aware of the Heartland Film Festival, but it's a pretty amazing festival that they're in their 10th year now. And, you know, finding a really good festival or creating a really good festival that supports and encourages good work, entertaining but inspiring work, is very difficult. And here's one organization that I can really point to and say, you know, they really do it right. They really encourage and inspire the filmmakers themselves to make good work. And they also recognize work that is not just... See, the problem that I have with some of the festivals that have been created or highlight films is they become kind of a search for a film that doesn't offend. You know, like a family-friendly film festival that, you know, they're just looking for films that maybe aren't that great, they're kind of funny or they're kind of dramatic, but they don't have anything in them that would offend anybody, and that's why we're going to play that film. And everybody can be comfortable and come to this festival and see these works, but they may not have like films that really aspire to something. And those are the hardest films to find. And so, at least, when we're talking about this film festival in Indianapolis, the Heartland Film Festival, they do have some films in their festival. It's held every year at the end of October. They have some films that may have some difficult subject matter, but are always kind of enlightening. And what they've come to, I recently became a member of the board of that festival. I went the first time as a filmmaker. I had a short film there, and then they asked me to be a judge. And then I would go back every year, the last couple of years, and they had this outreach program to local high schools. And I would go and talk about my films and talk to high school students about filmmaking and also the subject of uplifting entertainment. They recently came up with kind of a different definition for it. And what they're wanting to, because the people that talk about the festival sometimes do kind of start just talking about more family friendly, and I don't think that's kind of the definition that they're looking for. They are using a term now that they say truly moving pictures. So, and what is truly moving to you may be different than what's truly moving to me, but at least if Wade tells me about a film that truly moved him, I can't really argue. I can't argue that that's not a good film, because to him, it's truly moving in some way. And it doesn't. You don't have to be a film critic. You don't have to be have seen every film to come into it. It's kind of an equalizer. You can come into any group and say, here's a film that truly moved me, and here's why. I think there's a lot of films out there that are good films. There was an interesting article. I don't know if anybody saw this in the LA Times
on Sunday. Yeah. That article, something like that shows up about every other year.
Yeah, G is for grosses, and they talk about how they've done these studies over the years, and specifically talking about G and PG rated movies, which may not be totally the point that we're trying to make. But I thought this was a really interesting article, and talks about how three quarters of the films that were made last year were not PG or G, but the G and PG rated films made more money than, And I guess this speaks more, in a way, to kind of popular entertainment. But the thing that I thought was interesting about it is that they were reporting on kind of a shift in attitudes in the studios, in major studios, about making films that aren't as hard-edged, about trying to find the entertainment. And the interesting thing that they said about it is these are the most difficult films to make. And maybe that's why not so many of them are made, because to make a film that can engage people, adults as well as children, and be something that you can all enjoy together really takes a lot more effort. And I don't know if anybody agrees with that. But, anyway, I thought that was an interesting article. I've been involved the last year or 2 years in making television programs. Just recently, I was working on a show for the Learning Channel. It's called Personal Story. And it kind of works in their lineup of a baby story, a dating story. Well, a personal story follows people's journey as they're having elective surgery. And
to me, it's been a really amazing experience, and I just recently went on this one that I wanted to tell you about because it was a really cool story. It's this family in Baltimore, and I went, and they have this 5-year-old boy who was born with a short leg, and so they're doing this limb lengthening procedure on him. And I actually found out through interviewing them and finding out that this is a pretty unique center where they do this, that in most of the country what they would do for this particular condition of this boy would be to actually amputate his foot. And but they have the means to lengthen his limb. And I mean, I know we're kind of talking about movies, but Wade mentioned television too, and to me, I found a lot of personal satisfaction in doing a story like this that told the story of this boy, and they were just a really amazing family, and going through I was able to see unfold in front of me one of the most difficult things that this family would ever have to go through in their life as a family, and the procedure is such that they do this operation, but the parents become the surgeons because every day they have to turn this apparatus and it lengthens the leg and they have to do it correctly. So I think, as Wade mentioned, I think there's a lot, if you look for good programs, there's a lot out there that do exist. And hopefully I think this will be a good program. And then I think I guess the other point that I wanted to make is that it is incumbent upon us to find those programs and to support them. You know, we have more of a voice in what type of entertainment is produced than we realize, because if we support it and seek it out, and I think more and more people are coming to that realization that certainly if you go to a movie that, if you find a movie that you really want to support and you go in the first week of that movie, it helps that movie to stay in the theaters longer. And so we can't just sit and allow, you know, movies to be made that we don't like. You know, if the other argument applies too. If we're supporting those films with our dollars, you know, we're helping to create that in a way. So.
That reminds me, there's an irony to the fact that Richard Dutcher was inspired to start making LDS-themed films by the fact that gay and lesbian film festivals were so successful.
Right, because he found a niche audience.
He figured, you know what, if there's a niche audience to support those movies that are so out of the mainstream, then, you know, a church of 10 million people worldwide has got to be able to do something like that.
Thanks for all your comments. And now comes the free-form, wide-ranging question and answer, let's have it section of the program. And we know, we would be very open and willing to hear the perspectives of many of you in the audience who are involved. The people here are claiming you ought to be up here. You know. If you'd like to,
I'll throw in my two bits.
I'd like your two bits, please.
My two bits are that all these folks up here, I really respect. They're except for you, Matt.
Thank you.
But I don't know you. So
with time, it'll come. Really.
Well, I'll fast about that.
Thank you.
I appreciate what everyone has said here, and I think one of the most important things that we need to do is be having these kinds of discussions. I mean, since this is a Mormon forum, I think it's important for us to have these kinds of conversations, not just on a Saturday, but that we're having them on Sunday with the people that we worship with. And I think this notion, Rich, that you so nicely pointed out, of the difference between uplifting entertainment versus enlightening entertainment is really important. I think of, for me, some of the best lessons I've learned have been from films or stories. And maybe on one level people would say that has no redeeming value, except for the fact that you recognize the redeeming value is that it sort of follows a course of action or thought to its logical conclusion. And I think that's very important to recognize, that sometimes you can see things and sort of learn what could happen if you made choices like that. And I think that's enlightening also. And the other thing that I think is enlightening is the sense that happens when we make a connection with our brothers and sisters, be they members of the church or not. We talked about, Lisa, you said only kindness matters. You know, you think about the scriptures on charity. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what else we do. But if we don't have charity, we have nothing. And I'm going to be responding to Tosh's documentary tonight, which I saw last night. And it's really quite phenomenal. I hope everyone here can come to see it. It's at 8 o'clock, and it's quite an amazing journey of a family. And essentially, the couple meets when he goes on his mission. They come home, they get married, the perfect Mormon story. And 10 years later, she finds out she's HIV positive because her husband has been unfaithful and he's gay. You know, on one sense, this isn't unique to Carolyn Pearson. You know, this is a story that happens all the time, and the choices that they make and the way this affects their sons is just incredibly moving, and they're very honest about it. They're honest about how the church deals with it, which unfortunately is not, I think, ideal. I think they get a lot of support from members of the church. But the organizational church is not necessarily, I think, as supportive as they could be. And I think the church has made strides in those areas. But I think the church will make more strides in those areas as more enlightenment occurs. And not all of us are going to necessarily know someone, or maybe someone who will be honest to us about who they really are. But there are people or stories that will be honest for us. And that makes the difference. It makes a difference of seeing somebody who wrestles with gender issues or substance abuse issues or whatever the case may be. And I think as artists, one of the most important things to be is honest about that experience. We do a major disservice to ourselves and everyone else when we are not honest and we don't talk about the hard things. And I know that all you guys and gals sitting up there appreciate that kind of thing, and I admire you all because you try and do that in your work. And I think that makes a big difference. I think part of the thing, though, is helping others understand, specifically in our church, how that kind of honesty, you know, we don't need to necessarily be upset or afraid if we see God's army and see missionaries sitting on the toilet or pouring salt into somebody else's cereal during the prayer, because servants of the Lord would never do that, as someone said to me. And my response was, well, you've never been on a mission then. And so I think it really sort of does come down to the idea that only kindness matters, and charity is where it's at. And great art helps, I think, build a sense of charity and a sense of sort of the Jungian idea of connecting into the collective unconscious and a sense of us all being a part of this great family. And so that's my two cents on the, probably four, but...
If I could just add a little quick something to that answer to what Rich was talking about, I think the bottom line here and something that's always struck me is that we very easily confuse the entertainment impulse with the artistic impulse. And I'm not going to say, you know, it's one thing to judge a piece of music or a movie and say, is it art or is it entertainment? How good is it? Because that's totally subjective. But there's a difference between the impulse and the impulse of someone who says, I want to go out and I want to make something that's going to entertain people, it's going to show them a good time, it's going to make them feel good. And on the other hand, the impulse of someone that says, I'm having issues within myself, I need to somehow work those out in a creative way. And then, of course, the people who consume that. Sometimes when I go to a movie, I'm not necessarily going to be entertained, I'm going to be enlightened. Like Bruce pointed out. I want a, you know, a French film that I adore, Camille Claudel, it's about a decade old. The true story of the sculptress who had an affair with Auguste Rodin and wound up, you know, going mad as a result. An incredibly moving film, not uplifting, it's tragic. But I felt as though I suddenly could see her sculptures now, and I could understand the emotion, the experience, the life that went into that creation. And through the movie, I was able to do that. It's an amazing thing. There's a difference between those two impulses. And it's a delicate balance when, you know, you have to sort of know why you're going to see a movie, what you want to get out of it. And,
The only thing I was going to say is the only time I truly get offended is when somebody makes a movie, I mean, typically, not always, but usually studios are culpable for this, but they'll make a movie and they will put a sheen on it, and in terms of to make it more entertaining. I think Pretty Woman is one of the most offensive films I've ever seen.
Talk about it last night.
Yeah, really? I think it's just unreal that, like, a prostitute can be depicted in that way, because it's not true. It's not true to that lifestyle. It's not true to that profession. And in a way, if you want to talk about really damaging things that I think you can watch, but yet, I think it was PG, wasn't it?
PG?
I mean,
Radar. No, it was R.
Was it R?
Thank goodness. I mean, it's just, because I think it's a damaging film. I think it doesn't depict it truthfully. I think you can come out of there and you can go, wow, Julia Roberts is a pretty woman. She could be a hooker, and she doesn't kiss on the lips. And just the messages that movie sends are just awful. And I think, you know, I mean, I remember watching Robin Hood, you know, Kevin Costner. It's a horrible movie, but there's a scene in it where they're making light of a rape, that he's trying to rape her before, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, like, is this anything to be, like, laughing about or joking about, you know? I mean, and I think those are the subtle ways that are offensive, that we should be offended.
Okay, Chris, and then...
Yeah, I just want to... I've just been reading the David Geffen biography. I don't know if anybody's read that. It's pretty interesting, the operator. But his second movie was Risky Business. And the writer-director had a tragic ending.
Yeah.
And he said, no way. They've got to be successful. He's got to get into Princeton. He's got to, like, no, he's a pimp. There's a prostitute. You have to have a tragic ending. It's about how terrible capitalism is. Geffen goes, no, we're having a happy ending. We've got to have a happy ending. So it's very similar to Pretty Woman.
Yes.
I mean, there's a number of films like that where they've done that. I think Rich, you're absolutely right. That's the most insidious. The most insidious thing is a half truth. You know, we'll suck it down, and we don't realize that there's all kinds of barbs and hooks on it. And I was going to add something to that, and actually ask a question, but I think I'm developing Alzheimer's, so when it comes back...
If really quickly, if you want to talk about... Now, Pretty Woman may have been rated R. Crossroads, the Britney Spears film, recently released, rated PG-13. Technically meaning, if we can pick on the rating system some more... That if, a young girl is 13 or older, then it's okay. You know, parents shouldn't have an issue with her going with her friends to see it. This is a movie in which an 18-year-old girl finds out that it's okay to disobey her father, to run away from home, and to have sex with a boy as long as she thinks she loves him. And that's just the beginning. It's the message. If I had a 13-year-old daughter or a 14- or 15-year-old daughter, the thought that she could go and see that without my permission, without my knowledge, without my consent or my accompaniment, would horrify me. I'd be terrified. But on the other hand, again, the fact that girls of that age would be kept out of the Joy Luck Club, a movie about mother-daughter relationships, about the bonds that tie women together, that tie sisters together, that tie generations together, a movie in which messages about family are transcendent, I would almost say that every 13-year-old girl should have to see that movie so that they wouldn't put their parents through hell for the next 5 or 6 years. you know. So I have tremendous issues with, you know, using the rating system to sort of make those judgments. And any, because like 60% of the movies are now rated R, which basically says to me that this nameless cabal that sits in secret and you know, judges movies without our knowing anything about them or their process or their criteria, is scared to actually say what they think about these movies. They prefer to sort of pass it off to the parents and say, we're going to rate it R and let you deal with it. And, you know, anyone who says, well, I don't think there's any uplifting entertainment out there, but I don't see R-rated movies, you're missing two-thirds of the movies. You have no business making that judgment.
A little interesting insight into the ratings board. I know because I had to do this for a boss of mine once. When a studio turns in a film for rating, they actually will write down what they want the rating of the film to be. And that oftentimes the first, you know, I mean, it's not, well, what do I think this film is rated? It's like, is that PG-13? Yeah, I guess so. Off you go. You had something first and then we'll get to you.
I was judging at a film festival in Cedar City last week, and I just wondered if you guys had seen the Singles Award, and they've got some negative reviews in Salt Lake. And
is there anyone here that's involved with the production of Singles Award? Okay.
he wants to say what he said about you.
Okay. I thought he said he wanted to.
I sat next to a guy from Malibu who grew up in New York and he was outside chain smoking every 3 minutes, couldn't sit through the whole movie. And I got very nervous. I said, well, this is going to have some corny little Utah jokes and you won't get any of them. He laughed through the entire movie. And there was a lot of inside jokes that made it funnier.
Laughter is a very great way to convey truth. And that people, when they reach out to each other in honesty and kindness and tenderness and trust, and integrity and the person together. And it's too bad that theologically people get off on the subject and forget this real truth. And I want to say one more thing. This is a little, not exactly off the subject, because my tenant Lynn Workman writes for this thing, and I'm involved. For the first time in my life, I've involved in comedy about filmmaking. But one of my very favorite movies was Project X. Of course, I'm also a pilot. And of course, that was based on a true story.
You're a pilot?
Yes, I'm a pilot.
That is so cool. We'll talk about that later.
Am I a pilot? Uh-huh.
4,000 hours. So anyway, the only thing about the movie that wasn't true, because it was based on a true story, was the story of the chimpanzees that they had to teach it. They'd make a chimpanzee fly and shoot himself to see how high that they could go before they get into radiation and die. Well, one of the characters sort of fell in love with the chimps and they really liked him. So in the end, the chimps stole a Cessna and they flew in Florida and they landed and everybody in their cowboy and around. That was the only part of which
actually I was just going to say, I think you make a great point and what you bring up as well. I don't know how many people have seen that's just a fabulous film, Preston Sturges' film, Sullivan's Travels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The basic story being that there's a famous director and all he makes are comedies. And they're frothy entertainment, you know, and they're not really about anything important. And so he sort of goes off on this quest to write the great American film, and it's going to be this serious thing. And sort of he keeps coming up empty-handed. And at the end, he ends up in a...
Prison.
It's prison is what... Yeah, exactly. It's in prison.
Or they bring all the prisoners.
Or they bring them. Yeah, exactly. And they show one of his movies, and he's incognito sort of, and he hears them laughing. It's just such an amazing scene. He hears them laughing at his film, and he suddenly realizes that what he does matters. And you know, it may not be solving world hunger or any of those kinds of things, but I think there's absolutely a place for not quite loud laughter, but party laughter. I think that's 100 people have been quoted as saying this, but the good old dying is easy, comedy is hard, the actor on his deathbed. And there's a lot of truth to that, to make comedy that, or for that matter, any kind of, you know, Indiana Jones, you know, a fun adventure that's very fun. And I think that shouldn't be discounted, and we need some of those things.
We can have religious purposes
with those. Yeah.
But not the Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
I would have had which we
created
done
the PG-13 rating.
It did.
That's the film that was responsible for that.
Chris?
So real quick, what do you think of the best pro-Mormon film made in recent times?
The best
pro-Mormon? Of course, I'm talking about last week's Survivor episode, where the Mormon girl overthrew the whole power structure.
What's happening with her? There's a Mormon character.
She's the sweetest little corny Mormon you've ever seen. I mean, it's funny. And they were, like, in the power structure, but they knew after the beginning thing, they knew they'd be voted out within a few weeks. So they allied with the two black people, and those five overthrew the four hot shots and thought they were going to win everything. So it was actually,
wow.
So she, like, turned out to be, like, this really gutsy, smart person, you know, with this sweet little facade.
So the best film with a pro-Mormon stance is
a pro-Mormon film in recent times.
In recent times?
Besides
Yeah, you know, I'm all for the God's Army, actually, in that it was, you know, there were some kind of silly things in there. There were a couple of things that were a shape of the tribe, but from my experience, it's the most realistic portrayal of missionaries. Like, they weren't afraid to show missionaries as teenage boys with Hollins, which is what they really, I mean, there's this image of them that the church promotes and that the missionaries themselves do to some, you know, I know I did, even though I, you know, realized early on that, you know, they give me a black tag, I'm still just dumb Matt with a black tag. You know, there's this idea that they're these superhuman, ultra-spiritual, battery-powered, all they think about is scriptures and baptisms, and they're dumb teenage boys that oftentimes accomplish amazing things by virtue of their calling, and maybe the fact that there's 10 million people praying for them, and they're, you know, which, and but I don't know. I was proud of that film to be able to show that you know these are immature, dumb teenage boys, and they still are able to accomplish this. That's my tip.
I'd like to hear the rest of the panelists.
You know, it's a small group of films.
Yeah. You're asking what's the best of four films.
All four of them, and there's going to be like six by the end of the decade. I'm personally partial to Brigham City, and Brigham City is kind of the inverse of God's Army. You know, it's not about Mormons going out into the world. It's about an insulated Mormon community sort of trying to keep the world out. Which is ironic because it's not the way that we live in Los Angeles. But it is how most people in this country live, those who are and are not LDS. As I pointed out earlier, you know, most of this country is not the coast. It's not LA, San Francisco, New York, Atlanta, Washington. Most of this country are little towns in Nebraska and Kansas and Alabama and Idaho and you know, the Dakotas, where they have more senators than representatives. You know, this is a weird dynamic, if you think about it. We vote for our representatives because we have them all over the place. North Dakota has one representative and two senators. That's a small place. That's small town America. That's tiny. And they live like in Brigham City. They want to preserve a certain character. And what I loved about Brigham City is that it conveyed about Mormon culture the aspect that we do, that there is a difference between doctrine and culture, which we very often don't understand, but that there's also this yearning to preserve something that may not necessarily be at odds with being in the world, and that you could go on and on and on. But I think what Richard did with that film was analyze a lot of very difficult subjects in a very mature way and wrap them up in what appears to be a murder mystery, but it really isn't. Murder mystery is a sideline. What it's really about is about people grappling with a lot of very complicated issues, and the murder mystery just sort of gets you into that exploration. But I found that to be a great analysis of Mormon psychology more than anything else, and that's what I appreciated about it.
Chris?
Since I've only seen the Godfather once, I've heard of Brigham City.
Well, there's also God Baker, so you could find it.
I'm going to say something a little different. I decided, since I was very young, and when I was in high school, I knew every word to the libretto of Jesus Christ Superstar. It was one of my favorite rock operas, and I loved, and Tommy, The Who, you know, my favorite rock operas, and from that age, and I still have yet to really start to think about this, but I decided I'm going to write a rock opera about Joseph Smith, something along that line, so we'll... I don't know what the translation is to music, but I haven't seen all these films, so...
Well, this panel, Lisa, I just checked, is called Uplifting Entertainment. It's not just about uplifting movies. So we're sort of biased on...
Assuming your music is entertaining.
I have to say, I have noticed there are more Mormons getting involved in the whole kind of folk music circuit, and I've been to some folk festivals around the country, and there's a girl... Nancy Hansen has done pretty well, and I like music. I'm not saying mine's better or anything like that at all. I just feel like we have a long way to go in terms of music.
But if anybody saw, there was a piece in the LA Times about a week ago that said that the sales of pianos in Utah are something like 5 times the national average.
Wow.
And it talked about the importance of music in LDS culture.
Well,
it was great.
I love that we have such a great feeling for music. I mean, hymns, they're folk hymns, is what they are. They're for the people. And that we sing them so often and grow up with them, and they're just part of who we are, and that we're all pretty, whether we can sing or not, we all like to sing, you know? And,
have you heard the
that.
Hymns in the, what is it, the Saints, Soul Saints, or the soundtrack of Single Board?
I really like the soundtrack.
Where they've taken all the hymns, they've totally rewritten the tunes, all very modern, cutting edge, and it's really quite exciting.
That I really, really
like. But it's really pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, and of course it's exciting when people like Gladys Knight become Mormon and everything. And
don't forget Lionel Richie. Oh.
Yeah.
Mark.
Yeah. Annie Lennox was his member fellowshipper. It was very exciting.
But I will say, you know, there are some interesting actors that are Mormon that on The Providence. The girl that's the younger sister is Mormon. Also, I don't know that she's very active, but on that Roswell show, the blonde girl is Mormon. If you guys know that show, love you. That's your daughter!
That's your daughter!
I know. I guess
what's her
gone,
name?
But I love her. You know what show I loved her in? was the one with what's the famous? Yes, yes. She was so just precocious in that. I know. I mean, I didn't know how old she was, but I thought she was pretty young like that. She's a good actress. But do you guys go to church?
She said she is active.
She's active. Yes.
But we don't ask that at Sunset, right?
Oh, no.
No, I'm sorry. I'm saying it from a loving way. I love everybody, you know.
I'm really glad you liked her.
Yeah, that would
have
been really
hot. Oh, no, I like
she's a good
her.
Member, but she really sucks at acting.
This hat!
She's good.
Can we hear Rich and Mark on the Mormon?
Yeah, please.
I know we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
I well said with Brigham City. I think Brigham City's a better movie than God's Army, just in terms of cinema. And actually, I agree with a lot of what he said in terms of found it really interesting how it was, and a lot of really, I think a lot of the smart filmmakers do this, they'll use a genre to, the genre's just the disguise, the genre's just the vehicle to tell things that they're really interested in. And I think Richard did that well. And, by far it's the best reviewed film of the lot. come out. But I gotta say, I did see other side of heaven. I saw other side of heaven on Thursday, and I had heard not good things about the movie, and I really enjoyed it, and it was kind of surprised by it because I felt like, I mean, I had an interesting experience with Brigham. After I saw Brigham City, they were looking for a foreign sales agent, and I know a lot of those people, so I really loved it, and I had some ammunition, and then I had received a really great review from Variety and from New York Times, actually, gave a great review. And so I called a bunch of people, and we sent the movie out, or I just called Richard's, his office, said, look, send the movie over, I know you're looking for a presentation to sell it. And all the people called me back and said, how did you like this movie? I was totally offended. I felt like it was preaching to me. It was proselytizing to me. I was like, really? You felt that way? And then I came to
the... Mormons or non-Mormons?
Non-Mormons, yeah. And I came to the conclusion that, like, if you just address religion in a movie, I think people respond to that. They'll respond to that. They actively understand. Because I didn't feel like that movie had done that at all, but they had taken that away from the movie.
And just the fact that we are known as a proselyting church.
Right.
Such a...
The LA Times review of Other Side of Heaven, I think, completely reflected that.
Well, so I embraced... Exactly. So I embraced, you know, I embraced that reality that people are always going to respond to it that way, and you probably can't make a Mormon film without, you know... without a large portion of the population feeling that way that you're proselytizing to them. So with those eyes, I went in to see The Other Side of Heaven and loved it, because it was proselytizing to me, but I loved the production value. I thought the acting was decent. I didn't think it was horrible. And I thought, and it was a story that interested me, because I had served a mission in a foreign land under some same circumstances. And I loved it. I had an absolute blast. Do I think it's the level or the type of sort of filmmaking that Brigham City is? I don't. But, you know, I think people are always going to respond that way to Mormon cinema, you know. General population. I don't know if you can make a crossover movie, a truly crossover film, that if it's... I think you can make a crossover film. For instance, suppose The Rookie... The lead guy, that, you know, suppose he is a Mormon character, you know, it was just like, oh, he's a Mormon, and then the story moves on. Then it's going to be a crossover movie. But anytime you actually get into the culture or something, you know, like a very Mormon experience, people are going to feel like they're being preached to. So
I think it's probably Ocean's 11 with those two Mormon guys.
Yeah,
that's a great film. That's probably my favorite.
Okay, we have tried. I agree. I'm going to change my vote again.
You really like
that. Hey, was there a Mormon guy in Casino?
I didn't see Casino.
Oh, character.
Where's the money bag guy? That Mormon guy.
Well, that would be fairly true to life.
Yeah, that would be.
I mean, not the F word part, yeah. But the Mormon. The money. Anyway. Okay, we have just a couple minutes left, so I figure we got, how many of us are? There's about 10, 12 all told. We have enough time. If everyone can just give the most uplifting or worthwhile film they've seen in the last 6 months and maybe one sentence as to why it is. You know, we don't have time to get into a big, long discussion. Just one sentence, and if you don't want to give a reason, it's America. That's your right. But we'll just start up here. You can go to the back. And okay, we'll start over there while you're going through.
Yeah.
And let's go around and then through there and then. All right, let's start at the back. Chris, you're first.
Last night I saw Changing Lanes, which was sort of a redemptive story to it. I thought it was nice. Same with A Beautiful Mind. I took all my kids to see Schindler's List, and people said, that's R-rated. You know, it's like, is it okay? And I said, well, it's not. It would be okay. It's not okay for them to see it. It would be bad if they didn't see it, which is my attitude. I don't know. There's a bunch. I get inspired the most movies I can find something. You know, Lord of the Rings is a Mormon movie, by the way. Tolkien was a secretly Mormon. I don't know if you do that. Everything starts on September 21st, all the birthdays, same day as Moroni appeared, Joseph Smith. wise old man calls them on a mission, they go off, they come back, change forever.
you're pulling our leg on that.
I think Ian and Steve Martin joined at the same time.
Ian Martin. Ian Martin. I knew that was going on.
But you can read that into it if you want.
I love the Joy Luck Club, and that's old, but I took my mother and my two young daughters, and I think of that something. I think it's called Life at the House, and I really love it.
Written by an LDS screenwriter.
Really?
Mark Andrus.
I loved it, and I
have to say, Laura.
You're not going to say why?
Well, power corrupts, and it's that central issue that even the beneficial, well-intended use of power is corrupting. And I think I don't think the movie failed in that central theme. I mean, movies have a difficult time translating the deeper issues of most novels, but I think the movie in so many ways presented that, and you could say maybe it was overkill, but I just think it's beautifully presented, and if people bring that into their lives, that everyone has power, whether it's in a job, in a family, everyone has power. And everyone has the ring that can abuse that power, and it's a question of what do we do? Because we're stuck with the situation. We're all in power relationships. So I just think it's beautiful, beautiful tonight for that reason.
Thank you. Your next question.
I love The Beautiful One, and I'll tell you why. But it also goes into my background, because I'm also a mental health professional. And it started working with it, teaching kids and an athlete. And I started at age 9. And so often, and there was illness in my family, but it didn't break them apart. But so often, in people are afraid of illness. And they're afraid of infirmity. And sometimes when you encourage people and you believe in people and in through religion too, you get people closer together, people can come out of these things. My mother had an emotional breakdown before I was born, and I was born when she was 36. She never got over the loss of my brother until my son was born 28 years later. So in some ways, her life has been an suspended animation when she came out of it.
Thanks.
I see films all the time, so I love them all because I loved your comment about enlightening. For me, very rarely is a film not enlightening. But it can become uplifting depending on what I want to do.
Beautiful.
And so for me, like Mark Andrus is a role. So of course, you know, we see them all, you know, his latest projects and what's happening. Loved his films. I loved Harrison's Flowers that I saw recently only because I love the fact that it was a way to see ethnic cleansing without making you so offended by it. And it was a way for you to be aware of that. I raised teenage kids, and I tell them in my house we're not allowed to see anything PG-13. And any R-rated movie they want to go to, I go see them because I'm fine. PG-13 for sin. And take them into a world that doesn't allow them to think. And to me, that's what film is, to teach me that the conversations of what you do is what they do.
I would quickly say I'm of the opinion that the PG-13 is one of the most dangerous additions to the rating system because it allowed the studios to be able to start making films that otherwise might have gotten an R without having to be so restricted. It gave them a loophole. And I think it was supposed to be a good thing, but it was bad.
Amen. Man, I love Lord of the Rings. Amelie was just fantastic. I saw Frailty the other night, thought it was great, really very interesting ideas, especially from a Mormon standpoint. I thought it was quite fascinating. sort of an extended version of Nephi and Laban. And those are
things. That's good. All right, and we are over time, so I will pull the people in the front to the format earlier. You have one title and one sentence to explain why you like it. Go.
An Indian film called The Warrior, which will not be released here until next year. It's a medieval tale about a man who is an assassin for a local warlord, and at a certain point realizes he can't kill any longer, and he makes a pilgrimage back to his hometown and Tibet to purify himself.
It's going to come out next year?
Next year.
Look for that. Mine, out in theaters right now, Monsoon Wedding, an Indian film as well. Indian film as well. It's rated R, but it is one of the most beautiful, life-affirming things I have ever seen on film.
What do we call that? Crouching tiger?
Hidden dragon.
Leaping something. I just thought that it was so long, it was so intense, it was in Chinese, I love Chinese, and it was just so tragic, and yet it was filming, and it was passionate and filled with love, so...
There's a film that's coming out on Showtime, I think, in the next few months. It's called, it's a documentary called Devil's Playground. It's about Amish youth who go through Rumspringa, which is at 15 years of age. They actually are no longer in the Amish faith, and they can use electricity, and they've been working since they've been young teenagers, so they have money and they can buy things. And they have to make a decision where they're going to put all that aside and go back into the Amish faith, or whether they're going to become like a normal person. And it's amazing. They go through this incredible. It's as if if you said, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard Mormons say, "If I wasn't Mormon, what I would do?" These kids actually get to experience it. And the amazing thing is, it's 90% of the kids after they go out have sex. Tons of drugs, buy CD equipment, buy cars, do all this stuff, come back to the Amish faith.
What's it called?
It's called Devil's Playground. It's fascinating.
When's it coming out?
I think it's a Showtime movie, and I think it's going to come out in the next few months.
It's a documentary.
It's a documentary. It's true life.
Which is very cool.
Yeah. I'm going to say two films that I was recently reintroduced to. On video, and that is Searching for Bobby Fischer and Babette Spitzley, two of my really favorite films that I really saw recently.
Well, thank you so much for all your participation. Thanks for sticking around. Yeah.